Welcome to the next edition of the Rare Business Podcast. Today with me I have Alpha Dibé.
Alpha Dibé, that's right.
Alpha
Silent
Dibé.
Q, that's
Simon,
it.
Silent Q, thank you for that. So, welcome Alpha. First of all, tell us a bit about you.
Well, I have kind of a varied background. I'm currently a Chief Operating and Consulting Officer with Beyond Philosophy, which is a customer experience consultancy. I think we'll get into that in a moment.
Mm-hmm.
But my background kind of runs the gambit. I started off as a clinical neuroscientist, a research neuroscientist, and this is in New York. So I was originally interested in the question of what is a thought. That was like my original thing. But through this work, research, kind of got involved in public health. And at the time, I was in New York City, and I was kind of responsible for medical, physical, and psychological occupational health standards in New York City.
Okay.
And this is the time of Dinkins was the mayor and Giuliani was the district attorney, and they had always, they were going through this broken windows policing thing that you may have seen,
yeah,
or people may have heard about. In the, I think Gladwell wrote about it in his book Tipping Point.
Yes.
But that was my foray into what we now call customer experience, because the idea was the police department at the time, you know, had this emergency-based policing. Something happens, then you respond to it, and all the measures were, you know, reactive measures to something that I think in the UK you might call community-based policing or other kinds of things like that, citizen-oriented, citizen-centric policing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, my role was to understand the psychological, physical, medical standards required of a police officer in order to do that job.
Okay.
So if you've been recruiting big Marine, you know, lift 300 pounds, shoot straight kind of guys, and now you want people who actually talk to the public, who are friendly, and, you know, is it a different type of person or not? So
it's Robocop versus Kindergarten Cop.
Pretty much it. So that was my start into this. But at the time, all my background was sort of clinical.
Mm-hmm.
And as I got more in management, I quickly learned that I didn't really have a real background in making economic arguments. No one argues against public health. They argue that there's, we only have so much money and we got to make choices.
Sure.
And so all I could do at that time really was to make kind of medical, clinical kind of arguments, and everyone else is making all these very advanced economic arguments. So in the process of all of this, my academic background, just to make it short, is I have a degree in psychology, statistics, public health administration, and I did an MBA in international business and management.
Mm-hmm.
At the end of all of that, my intention was I'm going to go back into public health, make all these economic arguments, do really well, run the, you know, Department of Health in New York City, blah, blah, blah. That was like sort of my plan. But after I finished the MBA, Citibank made an offer that was
that
difficult.
He couldn't refuse.
Exactly. So, exactly. So I became a banker for a bit on something that was, at the time, I didn't really know much about segmentation, but they were attracted to my background being so broad.
Mm-hmm.
This was at the time of loyalty points, was just kind of getting started, really. And the Ford Citibank card was a reaction to the GM card, which was very popular.
Okay.
At that time, about 10% of purchases in the United States were made on a Citibank card. This was their fastest growing card product, but because they had designed it and in reaction to the GM card, they had all these people, but they didn't know anything about them. So my job was to tell them who these customers were, what is it that's motivating them, and get them to use this card in the way that they wanted them to use it.
So you were into big data before big data was even kind of on the,
pretty
on
much,
the agenda.
Pretty much it, yeah, exactly. And that was great for a while until I really recognized what I was actually doing, and that was getting people to max out their card and pay the minimum every month. And so I had a kind of a ethical, moral, exactly. So I thought, let me do something that's a little bit closer to healthcare, but pays like Citibank. So I decided to go into pharmaceuticals, and I went to Schering Plough Pharmaceuticals.
Okay.
And I did global business development for them for a while. And just about this time, the internet thing was really blowing up.
Mm-hmm.
And I really didn't know too much about the internet. But again, because of this background, and because I joined a strategic CRM firm whose foundation was Peppers and Rogers. So Peppers and Rogers had the idea.
Right.
This firm was going to take that idea and make it real. So they had technology, they had consulting, and they had this omnibus research type thing. And I was brought on board because some of their largest clients were sort of health related. So I understood that space, And the internet, it was new to everyone, so there wasn't, no one really had an advantage there. So I joined them, and I ran their internet consumer practice first, and then internet strategies practice. This firm was hugely successful, one of the fastest growing companies in the United States for about 3 years in a row. So we thought, we'll expand into Europe. So I came over to Europe to open up the office, the business for them, and that was based in London. And then just after I came over, internet thing blew up, 9/11 happened, so it was sort of like, Alpha, you kind of have a choice. I mean, you're welcome, you know, your job is your job, but we know you came over here, you just made the move over, so if you want to keep the package, we just cut it clean, and if we can go, or you can come back and get the job. And I thought, I'm here, and I always, you know, I said, I did my MBA in international business, I'd lived in Tokyo for a while and worked there, so I thought, I'm going to stay here and see what happens. Did that for a while, joined another strategic CRM firm, and then eventually left that and found Beyond Philosophy, which is a customer. By this point, customer experience was starting to take off, or just beginning. Thought Beyond Philosophy had all the building blocks for what I wanted in a career, so that's how I got to where I am.
And so tell us a bit more about Beyond Philosophy and the sort of the work that you do. I mean, sort of what sort of level do you sort of operate at? I mean, it just strikes me as, it's not a huge firm. It's kind of quite a high level sort of firm. Are you dealing with people more at sort of board level, sort of CEO level, or is it sort of across the board, different levels?
We're definitely at the higher end. I mean, board level, not always, but direct reports, that sort of thing. So we're usually at chief marketing officer, head of brand, customer services director, that sort of thing. Customer insights. Relatively rarely, and including CFO, which is interesting cases, and operations as well.
Okay.
So those are kinds of areas, and we tend to be either board level or direct reports kind of.
And the work that you're doing, is it more sort of strategy and analysis and review of kind of where companies are at, or is it sort of other things? Is it more? Is it the sort of the front end, or is it also the operational sort of bit, execution kind of element of it as well?
Well, it is, but it's we're not big enough to really get in and literally do all the stuff for all those companies. But what we do is we do the analysis. Where do you need to get to the design of this future? And then we help you implement various bits and pieces. It's usually when the companies hire us, they don't necessarily want someone in there to do it. They want someone to help them design it, and then on some problem areas to help out. Roughly speaking, there's three things that we do. Strategic guidance is one, kind of hear the thoughts, here's design. We do education. It's training, but we don't tend to do massive training for 5,000 employees. We tend to do either train the trainers, so we design the program, the module, something, or senior level education training, workshops and so forth. And also we call it customized research. So we're not a research house, but usually when there are more difficult questions which require a little bit more sophisticated approach or analysis, then we would handle those things.
So more bespoke stuff.
Bespoke is right.
Okay.
And usually, again, requiring a little bit more sophisticated technique. So most people wouldn't come to us even for a specific project with a few focus groups just on that basis. But we could do it, but that's not really our thing.
Yeah. So on my blog, or on the blog, I like to talk, most of the things I talk about, the common theme around all of the stuff that I talk about is customer-centric growth. Now, I want to know that, am I barking up the wrong tree, or is the power of the customer sort of rising? And if so, why is that, do you think?
Well, I think it's the answer is yes, primarily because, forget everything else, just from a purely macro point of view, businesses are good. Basically, successful businesses, large corporations, have figured out how to do a lot of the obvious stuff fairly well, and that means they and their competitors have all figured it out about the same, so they're about the same level. What they're doing is tweaking a little bit here, tweaking a little bit there. From the customer's point of view, sometimes they see that tweak, most times they don't. So from a customer's point of view, I look across the competitive landscape, it looks all about the same to me. So whichever one I choose, whatever. It's kind of the approach. As a result of that, businesses don't really have any power to keep a customer, to get the customer to spend more. It's whatever is happening in the customer's mind. And if they haven't investigated really what's happening in that customer's mind to figure out how to deliver something that's going to connect with them, then they're sort of it's just a game of chance.
So is it more to do with it's we're reaching a point of saturation of choice and sort of homogeneity, and i.e. that when you get to certain kind of markets that everybody starts to look the same, and therefore it becomes the power is not necessarily in the provision, but it's more actually in the sort of with the customer, and it's becoming that's the default position that's emerging, or is it something different to that?
Well, the way we look at it is this. Again, using the language of customer experience has these two halves. We think of it like a picture of an iceberg, which mm-hmm. you may have seen this thing.
Yeah.
There's a bit that's above the water, which is the rational experience,
yeah.
Which every company investigates. They know all about it. That's why their whole propositions, department, function is looking at what's the right mix and all that sort of stuff to address. But that's the one that them and their competitors are all about the same.
Mm-hmm.
So in that sense, that bit that's below the water level, that's the emotional or the subconscious experience. Most businesses don't know about that. They don't study it. It exists. They may, if you're a little bit more advanced, know that it exists, but you don't know how to deal with it. The opportunity, and this is where customer experience takes off, the opportunity is not in forgetting about the top part, of course, that's super important, but it's also to add the bottom part of that equation into it. So a business which understands the rational and the emotional experience
yeah.
has the opportunity to connect with the customer. If you forget about the emotional or for whatever reason don't pay attention to it, then what you're doing is you're leaving it to the rational experience. And again, as I've said, that's pretty much the same across the board.
I mean, would I be right in saying that you could probably largely equate the sort of the rational experience to things like technology, process, systems, training, all of that sort of stuff, how you deliver. But then the emotional stuff is more around what you deliver and almost how you deliver. And it's very much more the soft side of things, and it's more much more organic and more about people and culture and things. Is that right, or is that
it is true? But one of the difficult things about this is all the things that you would have listed at the top of that iceberg, the things you've mentioned, systems, for example.
Yeah.
That also has an emotional component to it.
Mm-hmm.
So the way most businesses have approached it is only from a rational point of view. Does it have these options? Does it have these sort of characteristics?
So, they've gone, it's hard and soft, but it's not hard and soft. There's hard and soft up here above the line and hard and soft below the line.
So to put it another way, everything that a business does, whatever it is, it has some rational components to it and some emotional components to
right.
it.
Okay.
So when you are selecting your CRM system, when you are putting in a billing system, even if the billing system is the most functionally perfect in the world, it has some emotional components to it. If you were to identify what the emotional output is from whatever that billing system or your IT or your bills or your letters or whatever else, your campaigns, your advertising, your how your people behave, design of your building, whatever it is,
mm-hmm.
it has rational and emotional. And the more you're able to take into consideration both of those aspects and the things that you do, the higher you move up. And once you start moving up this progression, what happens is you get loyalty,
mm-hmm.
you get higher cross-sell, upsell, all the things that businesses want to get.
Yeah.
So what we're really saying is the risk to not taking into consideration the emotional experience is not achieving those things. So when businesses have sort of maxed out what they can do in terms of the rational, which is pretty much what a lot of them have done, they've sort of maxed that out. They've cut every bit of cost they can out of it because they've leaned it, they've Six Sigma'd it to the bare bones.
Mm-hmm.
They've done all that they can do there, and they're figuring out how can we squeeze this next bit out of it. We don't have much room to go, but you got tons, you know, almost infinite opportunity, because what's not been explored, except in the last 10 years or so, what is being explored is this emotional experience.
Yeah.
And as businesses are starting to learn how to do that, then that's the opportunity.
Okay. So that's a huge task. I guess if you think about something that's rational and sort of logical and analytical and things, then it lends itself to becoming more exact and more precise, as it were,
mm-hmm.
more scientific.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the emotional side of things isn't necessarily so. It's a bit more sort of subjective, and
I think that's a fallacy, though. That's a fallacy.
You think?
And that's I think where Beyond Philosophy is excelling is exactly that. The reason why a lot of the emotional stuff hasn't been around, number one, it hasn't been studied, so it's at a younger stage. I mean, if you go into financial accounting and we went back 200, 300, I don't know, how many, 500 years, that had been an art as well.
Sure.
As the science of it develops, we start to understand a lot more things about it. That science is starting to be developed with this emotional experience, emotional engagement. As a matter of fact, it's a new thing. So it's not sort of you can just go out and find tons of papers. It's new. But again, that's where the opportunity is.
Okay.
And in fact, what Beyond Philosophy prides itself on, and I think where we get a lot of customers, is this what is generally considered the art of the emotional engagement and so forth. We're applying science to that. So
okay.
We quantify emotional engagement because we know, I mean, at the end of the day, whatever you talk about all these emotions, which everyone, even if everyone nods their head and agrees with it, when you get back to the boardroom and you have to argue, sort of going back to my public health days, yeah, we all agree that these emotions are there, but at the end of the day, we only have so much money, and what are we going to get?
You've got to make the economic argument for it.
Exactly. So what we've been doing is basically defining those quantitative relationships and understanding how emotions literally impact bottom line type things, and that's what we, that's sort of one of the things that we do.
That's cool.
Mm.
So you are the rocket scientists of...
Yeah, I mean, we are sort of thought leaders in this space, and what we, if you read our book, The DNA of Customer Experience, and the sort of last book that we've written, which is The Trends in Customer Experience, you kind of see that what we literally are trying to do is to, because we know we walk in, I mean, when Beyond Philosophy started, we were like so many other consultancies, kind of saying emotions are important, that's a new area, this is the area of rapid growth and all that sort of stuff, and everyone's... People kind of get that, you know, you get the, this makes sense, I like it, I like the sound of it. But
what
when
does
you,
it mean?
Exactly, when you get back into the, now I'm at my desk and I have to go to the, you know, finance director and say, I want to spend X on whatever project because this will, and this will, people got off on, a, I think, on the wrong foot with a lot of this stuff because they were thinking, I want to do all this stuff to make customers feel happy. I mean, okay, I mean, that's good, that's a great thing.
Mm-hmm.
But what's the return? What is the return on that?
Mm.
And other than a logical argument, a lot of companies didn't have an answer.
Mm-hmm.
So we thought, let's figure out if there in fact is an answer. And so what we do a lot of independent research, independently validated research.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the questions that we had early on was, okay, if emotions are important, so number one, are they important in driving business value?
Mm-hmm.
Is that in fact true? We did 2 years of research. We found out, yeah, that's in fact true. Second point is, well, if they are, which emotions? So we identified the emotions that literally drive business value.
Mm-hmm.
And what we're able to do now is to study an experience, the company's experience, to say what are the root causes of those emotions, and then what's the effect all of that has on business value. So satisfaction, loyalty, spend, you know,
yeah,
different levels of things.
Okay.
And that's what we're able to quantify for businesses.
That's cool.
Mm.
Where does, I mean, there's this word engagement, and then there's sometimes there's customer that goes in front of it, and sometimes there's employee that goes in front of it, and then it's always, you know, but then you put that in some businesses, and then any conversation that's got, or any term that's got customer in it, then marketing grabs hold of it, and then if it's got employee, then HR grabs hold of it, and then you end up with this sort of big debate about who owns that sort of engagement piece. Now, what's your view on the link between sort of customer engagement and employee engagement, and the sort of, are they intrinsically linked in terms of the delivery of kind of one and the, you know, the other, and can you address one without addressing the other? Do you have to address both at the same time? And what's your guys' kind of view on that?
Yeah, they're linked. They're brother and sister. You
okay.
know, they're fraternal twins basically.
Okay.
Do you have to address one or the other at the same time? Like everything in business, I mean, you know, there's ways of going about things. Most businesses don't have enough resources to do everything all at once.
Sure.
Okay, reality is the reality. But in the general concept, the idea is the business produces something, service, product, whatever it is.
Sure.
They produce something. At some point, I don't care which business it is, people are involved in the production of that thing and the delivery of it.
Mm-hmm.
Some businesses which are strictly internet-based, you could say, well, they don't, their people don't deliver. Well, actually, if there was no people involved, you know, even if you take your iPhone apps, all the apps in the world...
Well, a computer doesn't buy anything, right?
Exactly, exactly.
There's a person here, there's
exactly.
whatever amount of technology there, and there's a person at the other end.
Exactly. Because, I mean, if in fact, the argument becomes moot. Just go to any IT department and go to them and say, if people don't matter, then you really don't care who you hire in this department. Is that about what you're saying? So we already know the answer to that. So the idea is that literally employees deliver the experience. They design it, they create it, they deliver it. I don't care if it goes through whatever channels it goes through, but people deliver the experience. Mm-hmm. As a result, the employee experience is ultimately super important. I mean, it's at the heart of it. If you neglect it and you neglect your employees, it doesn't take a consultant, a brain scientist, or anything else to know that if you're neglecting your own people and they feel that they're being neglected and you want them to deliver this whatever it is, you know, fantastic experience, mm-hmm. that's not going to work. It's just not going to work.
You can't treat people badly and expect them to be nice to other people.
Exactly. It just can't. I mean, number one, why would they even follow you? At a certain point, it just breaks down. So there will be times at which you have to make tough choices. Business is business. And again, one of the I give this presentation often at conferences around the fallacies of fallacies of thinking and customer experience. One of those is that all of this, I think I already mentioned it, is about just making customers do whatever it takes to make customers happy. That's wrong. This is business.
You sure?
You don't need a consultant to know, because if all you have to do is do whatever it takes to make customers happy, I'd say give everything away free, make it the highest quality, do it very quickly. I mean, as simple as that. Mm-hmm. You'll be fine. The same thing goes with this employee thing. People are required, mm-hmm. and as a result, you have to treat those people in a way that's meaningful in that business context. Again, it doesn't mean give everything away, no. But you have to recognize the importance of employees. One of the big problems with a lot of this stuff is oftentimes people will think about customer experience, again, fallacy number whatever, three or four, is that...
How many fallacies are there?
There's about seven of them, seven big ones.
Okay.
One of them is that when you hear customer experience, so you just kind of said customer, okay, marketing, employee experience, HR. Another one is, well, when we say customer experience, we mean front end. So, yeah, customer service department, your guys are responsible for acting, behaving, right, doing
so
certain things.
It's like the skin on the orange.
Yeah.
And saying, well, actually, that's just all the experience, but whatever happens with everything else.
Exactly.
It's all
exactly. Exactly. And in fact, I just wrote a blog piece on how sophisticated customers are becoming now. And one of the markers that we're starting to see is that it used to be when, you know, go back 10 years, what you would hear people saying is, in fact, there was this kind of viral things where a customer's complaining to the agent on the phone and just getting on them really hard. Customers are starting to become much more sophisticated, understand that actually it's not the agent. I know, in fact, you hear them saying, I know this is not you, per se. This is not you. But you need to tell your company, blah, blah, blah. So customers are trying to get, they're trying to complain to get past the level.
Sure.
And understand that this person is, in a sense, doesn't even matter in the exactly, doesn't even matter in this equation. It's not who I am. And I'm not even talking about your manager. I'm talking about the company. I want to go deep into the company. Someone came up with this policy. Someone back in the headquarters somewhere developed something or other. So one of the things is that customers are seeing that it's people who designed this thing, who came up with this policy, who wrote this, who approved this. Customers are getting to that level. Mm-hmm. So obviously, if you're going to have all that stuff, effectively what you need is a joined-up organization. In fact, one of the views of customer experience that we use is thinking of customer experience as a pipeline, and you have these sections of pipe. Mm-hmm. And each section of pipe is a department. Mm-hmm. And as you describe, marketing and HR, sometimes they argue about who's what. Well, those sections of pipe, when they don't fit and sort of aligned, you basically get leaks.
Yep.
And as customers go through this pipeline, they feel these leaks. So there's a leak. Some of them mean something to the customer. Some of them, who cares? But what matters...
The leaky bucket sort of idea that I was telling you about before.
That's it. So as they go through this pipeline, these different departments, and they're not necessarily joined up, something isn't aligning them. They don't have a unified view. Each section by itself is perfect. I mean, there's no leaks inside this particular department. Perhaps that's the case. But when you get to those joints, that's it. You get a lot of these leaks. And customers recognize these leaks. They may not necessarily know exactly the cause of the leak, but they know that leak is not caused simply by the person they're talking to right then and there.
No, sure.
So this is one of the things.
They're not attributing necessarily responsibility. Mm. That's proving a real
challenge to organizations of how they structure themselves to respond to the market and the environment that they find themselves in. I mean, you feel that from some of the companies that you speak to, that they're feeling organizational challenges, and how do we create this joined up organization?
Well, I mean, that's at the heart of a lot of what you get. So when you get organizations coming in, understanding that they they don't have this joined up organization. Sorry, one of the concepts that's become actually driving a lot of business to us is exactly that. They understand the notion of customer experience, customer centricity, understand the notion. But if you were to separate individuals responsible for different parts of that organization and then quiz them on, so what is customer experience, customer centricity, you get probably as many answers as individuals you're talking to. So if you take those individuals and then say, now make it happen, as an individual running your division,
sure,
on day one, you wouldn't see much difference across the organization because they are kind of close together. But go 3 months, 6 months in the future, and they're all going off these slightly different directions. They're just pulling the organization apart. And the end result of that is the customer, not only do we have this small leak today, it's starting to gush at a certain point, and it's just pouring at another point in time.
And is social media and all of that, is that just exacerbating the problems and sort of exposing the leaks and posing more sort of challenges?
How organizations saw it at first. I mean, to be honest, is
sure.
We saw a lot of talk where we can't control how can we control what customers say and report in social media? So that was the first containment was the first idea. I think for many organizations, they've moved beyond. They understand they can't contain it. So it's about, well, what can we do to talk to customers? And again, still us talking to them. And then now we're into the, let's somehow listen to what they're having to say. What social media is doing is forcing, it's more forceful and pushing companies to listen to what we customers have to say.
Yeah.
Because if you don't listen, what will hurt you is that my friends and my colleagues will listen to me.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result of that, because everyone now understands this whole concept of this Net Promoter Score, I'm talking to my friends and my colleagues. I used to have to talk to you about the problem. I'd write you a single letter and you'd tell me, we'll get to it and we'll let you know if anything happens. One letter to one letter, and you really didn't care.
Mm-hmm.
And, it was one person. So unless I was the editor of the Times or something, who cares?
Mm-hmm.
Now, I could be Joe Schmo from whoever. I put my, if I have my friends and it's picked up by someone, and I, especially if I learn how to do it in a clever way so that I make it become viral, basically,
mm-hmm.
You recognize that could be anyone. The smallest complaint, the complaint itself might be relatively insignificant, but if my handling of the complaint goes off, that becomes the issue.
Mm-hmm.
So it's spiraling, but I think the spiraling is not sort of out of control, it's not detrimental, it's, again, there's opportunity. The weakness is, if you're not going to pay attention to it, all you see is this is hell for us. If you are going to pay attention to it and try to do something with it, then it's nothing but opportunity. We just wrote a white paper on complaints handling versus complaints outcomes. And what we found, we just kind of some sophisticated work on this, what we found is complaints handling is, I mean, people kind of know this, but complaints handling is more important than the actual outcome.
Mm-hmm.
A second finding we found, which we think was quite interesting, was we looked at the sensitivity to making other future complaints, and we found that there's a big driver of that is the amount of effort the customer puts into making this or chasing up this complaint.
Okay.
So if I have to put in lots of effort to chase this complaint, my likelihood of making future complaints goes skyward. If I didn't have to put in effort, so in other words, you start to take off that weight off my shoulder, you're kind of informing me this is going on or whatever is happening, you're handling it well, then my future sensitivity drops, which is kind of interesting.
So you then make the propensity to make future complaints would just drops.
That's right.
If you handle the first one.
That's right.
Genius.
Yeah.
That's almost counterintuitive.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah. Excellent.
I mean, in the interest of time and the things, I mean, you speak to different sort of companies, but if I was to say to you, so
if there are companies out there that are starting to think about their customer sort of experience and starting to really do something on their customer experience, if I was to say, what would be the top one, two, or three simple things, or not necessarily simple things, but the most important things that you say, these are the things that you wanted to get started in, and you can't say Call Beyond Philosophy is kind of number one, because that's not allowed until the end of the podcast.
Yeah, right. I think number one is to literally define the experience you want to have, you want your customers to have.
Right.
This is generally different than brand values. Brand value is very aspirational, what we would like to be, but the customer experience is literally today, what do you want that experience to be?
Would you say that's the same as sort of articulating what the customer journey is? Or is that different?
Slightly different. I think this is, I guess it depends on how you define the journey, but for us the journey is sort of, if you took particular experiences, or maybe you took about a lifetime journey kind of a thing, it's all about, this is what we want to have happen to the customer. I'm talking about, again, the rational and the emotional.
Okay.
So no matter what it is, think about it in terms of elements. If I said we have an app that we're going to design, make it even clearer, if you take banking, and you said one bank, the experience that they want to deliver is conservative and safe, you can imagine, if that's the experience they want to deliver, how they might literally design the space, the bank, the look of the place, how they might have the dress, the language people would use, and so on. If you had another bank who said, well, we're going to be fun and educational, you've got a totally different picture of what the space would be like, how the people would dress, maybe even the language that they would use.
Okay, I see.
And what we're talking about are identifying the elements of the experience that you want to pervade through everything, like we talked about at the beginning. Everything has this emotional and rational.
Right.
So what is it that defines the experience so that your designers, your customer service agents, your finance guys, your risk people, your security, your cleaners, they all understand this is what we're going to do and this is the way we're going to do that. So HR uses that information, IT uses it, finance uses it, and so on and so forth. So number one, define your north.
Right.
We all know what north is, but again, close your eyes, start walking it. We're all walking different directions. Mm-hmm. What is north? That's
okay.
Number one.
Okay.
Number two is, once you have that north, then you need someone who's going to have a little bit of carrot, a little bit of stick, to make sure that we said this was north, you walk on this path.
Okay.
And you need that in an organization. Does it need to be a chief customer, a chief experience officer? Titles don't really matter. What matters is authority, responsibility, and the will basically placed on from the board to say to this person, not only is your responsibility to step on our toes here and there.
You have accountability for this.
Yes, you have accountability. You're responsible for doing it.
Okay.
We want you to do it. So that's the second point. And the third point is, you need some kind of metrics. We typically talk about two types of metrics. There's global metrics, which is sort of your NPS, customer satisfaction. Everyone's measured. It's a number on a spreadsheet somewhere.
Yeah.
There's something else that we call local metrics. These are metrics which may be temporary in nature, but they get at a particular point.
Mm-hmm.
So just go back in time, the New York City Police Department, remember one of the guys in Times Square at the time, they were cleaning that up. It's not the Times Square we know now. But we looked at police officers and tourists, basically. And at that time, tourists really didn't ask police officers any questions. You kind of understood why, because the whole point of police officer at the time was to be intimidating. I mean, the police department was for criminals, and you had these guys standing out there, arms akimbo, just big, tough guys.
By deterring.
Exactly. Deterring crime, essentially, and everyone else. And so a local metric for a while was, let's just informally look at and see the percentage of tourists or people on the street who ask police officers for directions.
Mm-hmm.
At the start, none. At a certain point, the feeling, their stance, the style softened, and you get people who want to take pictures with the police and so forth, so that number goes up.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not a number that you're gonna have spreadsheets and charts and graphs. It's just to give you a sense of really where is the experience.
It's sort of more qualitative than it is quantitative.
That's it.
And
that's
a bridge.
That's it.
Excellent. So, that's fantastic and really insightful. There's so much stuff around. It's written on all this sort of around. It's just general business and in general is, I mean, how do you keep up? I mean, do you read blogs, or do you just kind of subscribe to certain things, or do you not subscribe to anything because it's just too much noise? And what do you do to sort of keep up and keep your thinking sort of doing at the forefront, as it were?
I read a lot. I wouldn't say I have a particular blog. I mean, Customer Think is one. I'll run across blogs. Your blog is one of them. There are others. there are others. I mean, we have a blog as well, obviously. So you know, we're writing on it. But I'm a Twitter sort of fanatic. What I like to do is just because I think what you need to do a lot of this stuff is once you get used to one particular site, you kind of get a framework and a sense of the angle that they're taking. But customer experience itself is developing. There's lots of angles, and also you need to hear the challenges as well.
And
I think Twitter is good for that. So it runs the gambit of things that I will look at. So some of it I look at sort of research oriented, some of it is sort of psych oriented, some of it is neuroscience oriented, and some of it is sort of business, sort of hard sense, no nonsense business type stuff.
Interesting. And the question I always like to finish these interviews on is there anything that you'd like to shamelessly plug?
Well, if anyone ever needed help and just wanted to understand, I guess, some basics of customer experience, and obviously Beyond Philosophy is a good place to start. I mean, we have information on the blog, so it's free just to have a look around there, and feel free to get in touch if anyone has any questions.
Alfred, thank you so much.
Yeah,
that's been fantastic.
Thanks.